The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Hello, and welcome to the recordings of the 2016 ACOI Internal Medicine Board Review course. The course was held March 30th through April 3rd, 2016 at the Renaissance Resort at SeaWorld in Orlando, Florida. It features nationally known speakers covering topics of interest to the physician preparing for initial certification or recertification in the specialty of internal medicine. Spondyloarthropathies and reactive arthritis is presented by Dr. Robert DiGiovanni.
So this is going to be our spondyloarthritis lecture. And again, I'd like to... Oh, by the way, I was just spending a little time with a couple of my residents, and they're going to be fellows this year, and they wanted to make me feel at home, so they came in late, of course, you know, so they just sauntered in. All right, so again, no disclosures on this other than there's been updated slides, again, by our junior resident, Rocky Shaw. Spondyloarthropathy means inflamed spine or growing together, or ankylosis, I should say. The first documented ankylosing spondylitis case reported in way back in 1691, although it may have been present in ancient Egyptians as well. We now talk about the seronegative spondyloarthropathies, where we just saw, now the popular term is just SPA. So you may hear this term SPA, and we have new criteria that were just released this past year, which I'll mention, and that we've included a couple of slides, of non-radiographic SPA. So we think that the incidence is possibly greater than rheumatoid arthritis. It's hard for me to buy into that, but this is the theory now. These are common features amongst the SPAs. Axial spine involvement is one of the sine qua non, along with sacroiliitis, that without which it would not be. So spinal involvement is a very important feature of this. Another feature is the asymmetric peripheral arthritis with DIP joint involvement and dactylitis, what we often or used to refer to as sausage digits. Inflammatory eye disease, including uveitis, which is a very important part of this, and a common constellation of mucocutaneous features that we'll review, a predilection for what we call enthesitis, or inflammation where tendons insert on bones. So enthesopathy or enthesitis is a very important feature of spondyloarthropathies. And uveitis, when you think about it, the iris is a functional enthesis. So this is just another place where the inflammation occurs. Tenosynovitis is common, and familial clustering and association with the HLA-B27 MHC protein, very, very common in these diseases. The list of SPAs include classical ankylosing spondylitis, reactive arthritis, which we used to call writers, but no longer call writers. It is just called reactive arthritis. Psoriatic arthritis and psoriatic spondyloarthritis. Enteropathic arthritis, or arthritis associated with the inflammatory bowel diseases. Juvenile ankylosing spondylitis. Undifferentiated spondyloarthropathies. And many people include reactive arthritides due to Whipple's, Behçet's, and celiac disease. The prevalence, previously thought to be 2.4 million with the newer criteria, may rise to 2.7 million compared to rheumatoid arthritis, which only affects 2 million. So ankylosing spondylitis is the most prevalent form of the classic spondyloarthropathies. It is present in as much as 1% and is much higher in Native Americans. There are Native American groups that have their own type of spondyloarthropathies like Navajo arthritis and so forth. Its highest prevalence is in Northern Europe and the lowest in Sub-Saharan Africa. So who's effective? Well, as Dr. Feinberg mentioned before, this is one where it's just the opposite as far as prevalence amongst men and women. 3 men to 1 woman when it comes to ankylosing spondylitis. Whereas psoriatic arthritis is more 1 to 1. Age of onset for ankylosing spondylitis is teens to 40 years of age. Approximately 10 to 20% of all patients have onset of symptoms before 16 years of age. So that may not present as and may not present either as sacroiliitis. It may present as large joint asymmetrical arthritis of the lower extremities, and that's a person in whom an HLA-B27 may be helpful. So what's the relationship with the HLA-B27? Well, in the normal healthy adult population, the incidence of the HLA-B27 antigen is about 8 or 9%. But we can see a much higher incidence in the spondyloarthropathies, over 90% in ankylosing spondylitis amongst whites and 50% in ankylosing spondylitis amongst African Americans. Reactive arthritis, we see it in about 70%. Psoriatic spondyloarthritis, where the spinal joints are involved, about 50%, and peripheral arthritis of psoriasis, about 30%. And then isolated acute anterior uveitis, about 50%. So HLA-B27-associated uveitis is an important feature. We have a lot of good treatments for this now as well. The pathophysiology, I don't want to spend a ton of time on it, but it's strongly associated with the HLA-B27 and these variants of genes. These are restricted to CD8 or cytotoxic T cells, and when you get certain bacterial infections, you get these, you get this molecular mimicry, and spondyloarthritis and reactive arthritis may occur. There's a lot of shared amino acid sequences between HLA-B27 and Klebsiella, so again, molecular mimicry. Enthesitis and chronic inflammation leading to fibrosis and ossification of joints occur, so you get that classic bamboo spine. Again, I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time on the cytokines and cellular involvements. Animal models show transgenic rats with HLA-B27 and beta-2 microglobulin develop an illness similar to spondyloarthropathies. Germ-free environment in those same rats, they do not develop clinical disease. So there's definitely a relationship to bacterial exposure in these rat models. The diagnosis is based on the presence of inflammatory back pain with enthesitis or an arthritis and radiographic involvement. There are numerous different criteria. There's the European Spondyloarthritis Study Group, ESSG criteria, the ARMOR criteria, and ankylosing spondylitis may be diagnosed by New York criteria, Rome criteria, and the CASPAR, or classification criteria for psoriatic arthritis criteria. CASPAR is a joint point system. 3 points or greater give you a diagnosis. For current psoriasis, you get 2 points. Any history of psoriasis, you get a point. But look at this: even a family history of psoriasis gets you a point. So you gotta elicit a good family history in these individuals. Presence of dactylitis gets a point. Juxta-articular bone formation, a point. You get a point for having a negative rheumatoid factor. So that's really good. You get a negative test, you get a point. And nail dystrophy, a point. Of course, nail dystrophy, these may be the old slides, you know, because we didn't get the new criteria in here. But let's go through this diagnosis. Okay. So the diagnosis of spondyloarthropathies. Is there inflammatory arthritis as asymmetrical or predominantly lower extremity? And or back pain of insidious onset greater than 3 months with morning stiffness and improvement with activity? Typically, these patients are under 40 to 45 years of age. Again, insidious arthritis, onset before age 40. That slide got in there out of order. Persistence for at least 3 months. Accentuation of back pain in the morning or after prolonged rest, and the back pain improves with exercise. And this is a classic picture from the ACR slide bank of a patient with restricted spinal motion. And I was always happy that they allowed him to wear his slippers in this particular slide and preserve his dignity. Okay, so note of those questions. Unlikely to be a spondyloarthropathy. Yes. Is there evidence of psoriasis or inflammatory bowel disease? So this is all part of your thinking process. If there's no evidence of psoriasis or inflammatory bowel disease, is there radiographic evidence of sacroiliitis? Is there enthesopathy, dactylitis, unilateral or alternating buttocks pain, family history? Is there a history of uveitis or iritis, that is, in the past? Have they had acute diarrhea or non-gonococcal urethritis or cervicitis within a month of the arthritis onset? Now, if they have had psoriasis or inflammatory bowel disease, you consider enteropathic or psoriatic arthritis. If not, we're back to that other box. And if the answer is no, again, unlikely to be a spondyloarthropathy. If the answer is yes, then it's likely to be a spondyloarthropathy. So, probably at that point, you're dealing with reactive arthritis or Reiter syndrome, what we used to call Reiter syndrome. Is there evidence of a chlamydial infection? No, then it's reactive arthritis. Yes, then consider chlamydial-associated reactive arthritis, and one would treat that, of course, with antibiotics. Now, coming back to the ESSG criteria, again, is there inflammatory back pain or synovitis, asymmetrical, predominantly the lower extremities? Secondary, we like to see one of the following: psoriasis, inflammatory bowel disease, positive family history of psoriasis, history of urethritis, cervicitis, or acute diarrhea, alternating buttocks pain, enthesopathy, and sacroiliitis. Tests that we can do for the axial spine, one is the Schober test. We expect greater than 5 centimeters of movement between two lines, 10 centimeters apart. I'm going to show you a picture of that. Spinal fusion results in irreversible impairment, but reduction in mobility can also be induced by pain, muscle spasm, so it could vary between visits. With advanced disease, leads to loss of lumbar lordosis, exaggeration of the thoracic kyphosis, and an inability to extend the neck, and compensatory hip flexion contracture deformities. Since you get involvement of the joints around the chest, you also get a decrease in chest expansion. This can result in a decrease in vital capacity and total lung capacity. So various tests that we use to see how they do from one visit to another is an occiput to wall distance, tragus to wall distance, chest expansion, Schober test, and sacroiliac stress test, we call it. Here's a Schober test. You draw a line at the base of the sacrum, another line 10 centimeters above that, and then have the patient forward bend. Those two lines should distract at least 5 centimeters. If they don't, then that's a positive Schober test. So this is very advanced diagnostic stuff in the field of rheumatology. They may also have anemia, elevated sed rate, and C-reactive protein, which C-reactive protein does seem to be a little more disease-specific to reactive arthritis. Renal function may be impaired. They may have elevated IgA levels and develop an IgA nephropathy. They are typically negative rheumatoid factor and positive HLA-B27. Other general manifestations, ocular, including acute anterior uveitis, osteoporosis, GI involvement, including bowel inflammation, cardiac, may get ascending aortitis and aortic regurgitation, pulmonary, atypical fibrobullous disease, neurologic, spinal fractures, called Aquinas syndrome, and rarely secondary amyloidosis and retroperitoneal fibrosis. So here we have a patient with uveitis. The upper right picture shows a hypopyon. You can see the flat layer of pus in the anterior chamber of the eye. Hopefully you can see that from where you are. In later disease, you can see here at the bottom, not only do they have an episcleritis, but they've got synechiae formation. So they've got scarring now of the iris, and it's out of round, and it can't contract. And we can see the likelihood of iritis in these various diseases, but ankylosing spondylitis, upwards of a third of these individuals. Same thing with Reiters. So very common. We see iritis much more common than in, say, rheumatoid arthritis or lupus and so forth. X-rays of the sacroiliac joints, we see iliac erosions or postage stamp serrations. These erosions become more prominent and may cause a pseudo-widening initially of the sacroiliac joint. Eventually, they fuse and it becomes a fibrous fused joint. And sacroiliitis, again, is that sine qua non of spondyloarthropathies. And this shows a normal sacroiliac, or I should say early inflammation on the left, which is hard to see. And then you can see complete fusion of the sacroiliac joints in the image on the right. Romanos lesions, shiny corners of the vertebral bodies and squaring of the vertebral bodies, because the inflammation in the spine and ankylosing spondylitis is in the outer fibers of the annulus fibrosus. Eventually, they get those little fine bridging syndesmophytes, and you get the typical bamboo spine. This shows the bony squaring of the vertebral bodies that occurs in ankylosing spondylitis, and this is the earliest, or one of the earliest, radiographic features of ankylosing spondylitis. Now, MRI is our most exact way of determining if there is sacroiliitis. If you are suspecting sacroiliitis or suspecting a patient with spondyloarthritis, then and you have negative radiographs, you need to get an MRI of the sacroiliac joints, and a lumbar MRI won't cover it. You'll have to ask for a sacral MRI. And this is a most, sensitive way of determining whether or not there's sacroiliitis. It can detect early inflammation and give us these so-called diagnoses of non-radiographic SPA. All right, ankylosing spondylitis. We're going to take each one of these spondyloarthropathies in turn. It is the most common cause of inflammatory back pain in young adults. Apparently, we're missing a lot of these patients. If you've got someone that's had insidious onset low back pain, they're under the age of 40 or 45, and it's not going away. It's the type of pain that is better with use. It's alternating buttocks pain, maybe improves with exercise, improves with NSAIDs, then you need to start considering that this could be a patient with a spondyloarthropathies. The male to female ratio, of course, 3-1, as we've said. Sacroiliitis, which is symmetrical, and spondyloarthritis is the hallmark of the disease. Later on, we can see the bamboo spine. Enthesitis is a feature, peripheral arthritis, another important feature. Here we see the squaring of the bony, the vertebral bodies on the left, and eventually the bamboo spine on the right, where we get those fine bridging syndesmophytes. And by that point, I mean, you're way on into the course of the disease. This shows a person that between 1947 and 1973 was someone in somebody's practice. Again, this is in the ACR slide collection, and you can see the progression of disease. I'm not sure how he got taller in the last one. I think they took away his cane and gave him Grecian formula because he looks better in that one, and that was way before we had any good treatments. All right, what are the extra-articular manifestations that can occur in ankylosing spondylitis? There's a good mnemonic for this, ANKSPOND. And under with the heart, with the under A, aortic insufficiency is always, I don't know, it's always a rheumatology board question, but aortic regurgitation, that's the one you want to know about. With neurological, you can have anatoaxial subluxation called Aquinas syndrome. Kidney can have secondary amyloidosis. Cervical fractures, ocular, such as an anterior uveitis. Pulmonary, here you get a very unusual pattern of interstitial fibrosis. It is upper lobe fibrosis with restrictive changes. In the kidney, you can get an IgA nephropathy, and you can get discitis. Additionally, 30 to 60% of patients have an asymptomatic or a subclinical colitis. So here's that atypical biapical pulmonary fibrosis that can occur in ankylosing spondylitis. As Dr. Feinberg likes to say, if you see this, skip to the bottom and just check off ankylosing spondylitis. It's unique amongst the autoimmune diseases in this pattern of pulmonary fibrosis. Move on to reactive arthritis. This is an autoimmune process that develops 1 to 3 weeks after bacterial infection. It could be associated with C. trachomatis, Shigella, Salmonella, Yersinia, Chlamydia infections. You get that urethritis, and that was the old saying, can't see, can't pee, and can't climb a tree. You treat the underlying infections initially. If continues, you may need analgesics, steroids, or move on to immunosuppressants. There's a lot of cutaneous manifestations, including keratoderma blepharagicum, oral and genital ulcerations, and conjunctivitis is seen in these diseases. But you don't absolutely need that complete triad of urethritis, conjunctivitis, and arthritis to make the diagnosis. Infectious triggers for enteropathic or enterogenic, Shigella, Campylobacter, Yersinia, and Salmonella are common. Be aware of that. Chlamydia and gonococcal for urethritis. And now we're seeing more with Uroplasma and Clostridium difficile. So with the C. diff explosion in the hospitals these days, I wouldn't be surprised if you see this in younger patients to develop a reactive arthritis. The prevalence is 16 per 100,000, primarily young adults, ages 20 to 40 years of age. A male-to-female ratio is 1-to-1, but the male-to-female ratio for urogenital reactive arthritis is a little higher. It's rare in children, uncommon in blacks. The arthritis can be a monoarthritis or oligoarthritis. So oligo, as mentioned before, is 2, 3, or 4 joints. Sacroiliitis, spondyloarthritis, and enthesitis, all features of these diseases. Now, the majority of these cases, 70 or 80%, are going to remit within a year. Some will go on to develop a chronic arthritis and require ongoing treatment. Some of the features we might see are balanitis circumscripta, as seen here. This is keratoderma blepharagicum. It's this, it almost looks like a pustular warty psoriasis on the soles of the feet. And this is a feature of reactive arthritis. So if you see this again, keratoderma blepharagicum is a question they love to ask over and over. Psoriatic arthritis may be present with or without skin changes. A good thing to do when you examine these patients, look for hidden psoriasis behind the ears, in the umbilicus, check their nails for pitting, ridging, and onycholysis. The arthritis doesn't necessarily correlate with the activity of the psoriasis. They may have had psoriasis 20 years ago, and now they have an inflammatory arthritis. They could get an RA-like arthritis. Dactylitis is very common in these individuals. Prevalence is right up there, 100 per 100,000, 1 in 20 people who have psoriasis. Psoriasis precedes the arthritis in 2/3 of the patient, and arthritis precedes the psoriasis, or occurs simultaneously in about 1/3 of patients. Now, very bad explosive psoriasis these days is a feature of advanced HIV infection. So if you have a patient with no family history, this is kind of a pearl. You see them in a hospital, and they just have this explosive, horrible plaque psoriasis with no family history or no prior history. And HIV is something that you should definitely check in all of these individuals. There are 5 classical presentations of psoriatic arthritis: asymmetrical oligoarthritis, and this may occur with dactylitis; the symmetrical polyarthritis, I call this indistinguishable, it might look just like rheumatoid arthritis; DIP involvement, they typically have the nail dystrophy; arthritis mutilans, it speaks for itself; and spondyloarthritis with or without sacroiliitis. Here we see that asymmetrical arthritis of the joints. On the left hand, you can see synovitis and sausaging of the left fourth finger as compared to the right. All of them pretty much have DIP joint involvement and advanced asymmetrical onychodystrophy. Here we see an asymmetrical arthritis of large joints where the left knee has a suprapatellar effusion. Hopefully you can appreciate that. And then the right knee has none. Arthritis mutilans, where we see telescoping fingers, where they just start to telescope in like an opera glass. This is radiograph showing arthritis mutilans and osteolysis of involved joints. Didn't come out that well, though. Sausage digits, okay? This is in contradistinction to, say, fusiform synovitis that we see in RA. In RA, you get fusiform synovitis of the joints because that's the only place that the inflammation is occurring. But with psoriatic arthritis, the entire ray becomes inflamed. The extensor and flexor tendon sheaths become inflamed, so the whole thing sausages up. So that's dactylitis. Enthesopathy, very common, where we can see these Achilles tendonitis, any place where tendons insert upon bones. Enteropathic arthritis. So what bowel diseases are associated with spondyloarthropathies? Well, idiopathic inflammatory bowel diseases, certainly about one in five patients, about 20%, can get arthritis. Microscopic colitis and collagenous colitis. Whipple's disease. So Whipple's is a little bit different. You know, you've got to get that Whipple's bacillus to make the diagnosis. Gluten-sensitive enteropathy and celiac disease, that is. And patients that have had the old intestinal bypass surgeries or gastric bypass surgeries for obesity and so forth may get these due to an overgrowth of bacteria. Inflammatory bowel disease-related spondyloarthropathies, obviously a history of abdominal pain, bloody diarrhea. They may have an axial or peripheral form of arthritis. The prevalence is 5 per 100. Male-to-female ratio is the same, children equal to adults. The arthritis, it may be of acute onset, may be migratory, asymmetric, and typically it is oligoarthritis. Extra-articular, they may develop uveitis. These guys can also get enodosum, aphthous stomatitis, and pyoderma gangrenosum. Remember, we mentioned pyoderma in the rheumatoid arthritis lecture. That feature is shared with ulcerative colitis and enteropathic arthritis. Erythema nodosum is a paniculitis where we see these tender red nodules in the pretibial area. So this is common in these patients. Treatment may be non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, sulfasalazine, this is in general, and the anti-TNF medications make these patients feel a whole lot better. Short-term corticosteroids may be used, but in general, we frown on long-term use of steroids in spondyloarthropathy patients. Intra-articular steroids are a good adjunct to the treatment. Methotrexate, azathioprine, cyclophosphamide, and cyclosporine have been used in SPAs. They're good for the peripheral arthritis, not very good for the axial skeletal arthritis. Leflunomide has been used in random controlled study of ankylosing spondylitis, not found to be effective. Follow-up includes assessment of fatigue, back pain, mobility, synovitis, and enthesitis. You need to see your ankylosing spondylitis patients every 6 months, listen to their heart, listen for a murmur, very important, okay? Surgery is occasionally useful. Physical therapy is very important. These patients may go through an inflammatory phase that lasts only 10 or 15 years. You have to keep them mobile.